This is Focus 580, our morning talk program, hour number two. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. In this part of the program, hour two, we'll be talking with Daryl Byler. He is director of the Washington Office of the Mennonite Central Committee. We'll be talking a bit about the work of the Mennonite Central Committee, its connection with Mennonite churches, and we certainly have them here in our areas. And we do want to mention as well that our guest, Daryl Byler, is actually going to be here in Central Illinois this weekend. He'll be giving a talk at the First Mennonite Church of Champaign-Urbana tomorrow at 7 in the evening, and then he will also be speaking at East Bend Mennonite Church. That's near Fisher, and that would be Sunday morning at 9:30. And the folks in both congregations want to make sure that everyone feels welcome to attend one of these events. As we talk this morning by telephone with Daryl Byler, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Here in Champaign-Urbana, again, 333-WILL, and the toll-free 800-222-WILL. That one's good anywhere you can hear us over the air, Illinois, Indiana, surrounding areas, and also for people who are listening on the Internet. As long as you're in the United States, you may also use that line. Mr. Byler, hello.
Hi, good to be with you.
Well, thanks for talking with us today. We appreciate it. Perhaps I would ask you first to talk a little bit about the Mennonite Central Committee and about how the committee is connected to the individual Mennonite churches, like those that are here and in our area where you'll be this weekend.
Well, MCC, or Mennonite Central Committee, is an international relief, development, and peacebuilding agency, and it is basically sponsored and owned by Mennonite and Brethren in Christ churches in Canada and the U.S. So there are churches across the country, as in Champaign-Urbana area, who support our work on a regular basis each year for the last 85 years.
And what sort of things has, what sort of activities has the Mennonite Central Committee been involved in?
Well, we have approximately 1,200 workers in some 55 countries. We respond to situations of disaster. One of the most recent major disasters, of course, was the tsunami. We also respond in situations where there are the after effects of war or famine, poverty. And we respond in a variety of ways, sometimes with relief supplies, but often we try to move to a development phase and also do address advocacy issues and public policy issues that would have impact on the places where we're working around the world.
Mm-hmm. I know that there are a number of religious organizations that do this kind of thing and who feel that doing what one might call missionary work is part of what they want to do. And I think that there are probably also groups, organizations who want to draw a line and say that, in fact, they feel that they are doing a kind of witnessing by doing the relief work that they do, but that it's not proselytizing. They're not going out there actively seeking to convert people in the process. And then I suppose there are some who think indeed that is a very important thing. It may be the most important thing. How do you think about where you draw that line between doing something that is purely intended to be a humanitarian kind of relief effort and something that is about telling people about your personal religious faith?
Right. Well, I think, MCC's tagline is that we do our work in the name of Christ. But I think we do see ourselves as an agency that begins by doing and by practicing our faith. And as we have opportunities to talk about our faith and what motivates us, we take that. But our goal is not to plant churches. There are Mennonite mission agencies who do that. That's not MCC's particular focus. We try to work through existing local churches in the countries where we work. We often work with Muslim organizations as well. And our attempt is to, as I say, to work in the name of Christ, but not to try to to pressure anyone to become a Christian, although that's obviously a great thing if that happens.
How do you know offhand how many Mennonites there are in, say, in the United States?
There's quite a few stripes of Mennonites, but somewhere in the order of 200,000 to 300,000. And then there's related families of Brethren in Christ and Amish, mm-hmm. Who also support MCC.
The Mennonite Church is one of the historic peace churches, and has historically now for a long time been committed to nonviolence and to pacifism. And it also is, I think, true to say that Mennonites believe very strongly in being involved. I don't know if you would use the word being involved politically, but I guess that's the way I think about it. And in the sense that some people would say that what their faith is about, it's about the way they live their personal lives within their personal sphere. And then there are other people who would say that that their religious faith makes it incumbent on them to go beyond that. And that if they feel that the policy of their government, for example, is wrong, that they feel that their religious faith says to them, you can't just sit there in your house and think that it's wrong. It's your responsibility actually to be talking about that, and to the extent that you can, to go and confront the government and say, we think that this policy is wrong. And I'm interested in having you talk about that for yourself as a Mennonite, and then perhaps this opens the door to talking in a little bit larger sense about the place of religion in public life. But just speaking for yourself, why is it that you think that is something that is it's not only just important, but it's something that you feel called to do?
Right. Well, I think a lot of that actually has grown out of MCC's international work. And frequently in the countries where we work, the partner organizations that we work with there will call us to speak to the U.S. government because they do feel concerned about how U.S. public policies affect their lives. And so it's kind of a matter of integrity that if we say that we're concerned about the people that we work with, that we then need to address the kinds of issues that they raise up for us. So that's actually a major focus of the MCC Washington office where I work, that we try to just pass along those stories and concerns to policymakers here in Washington and make sure that those stories are taken into account as foreign policy is discussed in the nation's capital. And I do think it's a question of trying to love neighbor as self, that I think historically when Mennonites had concerns about how they were being treated in this country or when they were appealing to have alternative service as opposed to doing military service, those concerns were expressed to government leaders in very clear ways. And so we're trying to expand that and express the concerns that our sisters and brothers in other parts of the world have.
I think that to me that's an interesting kind of feature, and perhaps it does go to the history of what the Mennonite experience has been. This idea that while all Christians would recognize this basic injunction of loving neighbor as self, but that everyone doesn't extend, you know, that gets back to the old question which led to the famous story, that question, well, who's my neighbor? What this is drawing the circle very large, and this is not something that everyone is willing to do.
I think that is probably a theological understanding for Mennonites, that we are part of a global family, that the church or the body of Christ extends beyond our own neighborhood and our own nation even, and includes people from around the world, and so that we do have a large circle when we think about neighbor.
I understand, though, that within the Mennonite Church there is sometimes controversy about just what sort of stand people are going to take and the church is going to take. Is like, perhaps like any other body, everyone's not of the same mind. There are people that, for want of a better word, I guess you would say were liberals, and people who you would say were conservatives. Just how controversial or how much argument is there when groups of people who are trying to get together as a group and sort of decide where the entire community is going, when people like that get together and talk, how much argument is there about what positions the church or the community of the church should take?
Well, I think it would be fair to say that there's pretty lively debate. And you might think that in a peace church that wouldn't be the case, but I think it is. And it's sometimes it's been to the point that I think it's been uncomfortable enough that some congregations just choose not to talk about the differences. Our office has really promoted in the last year a concept of safe space dialogue, where we've laid out an approach, a process for congregations to really have conversations over issues about which there is serious disagreement, and to try to get to what are some of the underlying values that people from across the political spectrum take. And I think we became aware of the need for that after the 2004 elections and realized that the red-blue divide was very well alive in the church, mm-hmm. and that we wanted to, as a church family, find a better way to bridge that divide than what maybe is happening in the broader society.
Well, can you give me an example of one particular issue that seemed to be very divisive, and how people have at least gone about trying to talk about their differences?
Well, one of the issues that has a lot of opinions on in the church is specifically the role of the military. There would be some Mennonites who would say, "Well, I couldn't serve in the military, but I believe that God has ordained governments, and that governments have militaries, and they go to war, and that's the way it is." There would be others who would say, "Not only could I not serve in the military, but I don't really believe that God's intention is to use lethal force to resolve global conflicts, and so that not only will I not fight, but I'm going to encourage my government to move away from violent uses of force and growing militarism." So that debate is very alive in the church, and so some people say, you know, we shouldn't be challenging government on that issue. That's what governments do. Others say, no, that's what we need to be doing as people of faith. We need to be talking to our government and presenting alternative approaches to addressing security threats.
Hmm. So how I take it there on this particular issue there, you're having discussion, maybe very spirited discussion, but not something that there's consensus on? I'm not even sure that's something there can be consensus on.
Yeah, I think the point is not necessarily to get to consensus. That's obviously nice when it happens, but at least to have a fuller understanding of where people are coming from and understand how their faith has led them to that position, how their life experiences have led them to the place they are, because it seems like what very easily happens is that we tend to demonize people who have a different position than us, and then we instead of dialoguing, we either just write them off or are extremely critical of them. And our hope is that in the church, at least, we can find ways to at least respect each other, and hopefully by listening to many points of view, we will move toward consensus at least.
Let me introduce again our guest for this hour, Focus. We're talking with Daryl Beiler. He is director of the Washington Office of the Mennonite Central Committee. The committee is involved in sending people and resources around the world to communities who need help recovering from war and natural disaster. They also, among other things, work with people to help them develop skills for creating peace in their own lives and their homes and their neighborhoods. He says, in addition, one of the goals is to perhaps influence long-range changes in the government, American government policy. He will be here in Champaign-Urbana tomorrow. He'll be speaking at the First Mennonite Church of Champaign-Urbana tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. And then he also will speak at East Bend Mennonite Church. That's near Fisher at 9:30 in the morning on Sunday morning. And the folks there, again, as I said at the beginning, at both congregations want you to know that anyone would be welcome to attend either places. And, of course, questions here are welcome, too. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. It seems now increasingly common that people here in the United States in political life, particularly people who are either have elected office or are running, are becoming much more vocal in talking about their religious faith and how it motivates them and how they think about doing their jobs and doing policy. And I'm not sure that it's necessarily the case that people in politics are now more religious than they used to be. I think, though, that people used to be more quiet about it. They kept those two parts of their lives sort of separate. I know they can't really completely be separate, but there wasn't so much God talk coming into the public dialogue.
Right.
Now that has changed. This is a very significant change, and I think it's something that there are some people who think that that's very good, and there are some people who are very uncomfortable about that and would like to return to that time where it was sort of a no, don't ask, don't tell kind of policy when it came to people's religious faith. And I'm interested in what you think about where it is we are now with this very public talking about people having, in a very public way, talking about their faith and then what that means for them and what they're going to do. Do you have strong feelings about whether that is good or whether that is problematic?
Well, I think it's important that public policy is influenced by people of faith. I think it's important how we do that and that our approach to the public square is one that's invitational, not trying to impose our points of view on others, but that we invite based on our ideas and our best practices, and that again, I think our public witness has much greater integrity if it grows out of our lived out experience as the church. And I think sometimes people in the broader society feel like the faith voice is rather shrill and maybe harsh and judgmental, and that there would be a lot more space for a bit more humility and trying to point to our best practices and examples as a church, so that when we're speaking and calling government to do things, we can point to the kinds of practices that we have as congregations and denominations and say, you know, here's how we're trying to work at this, and we present this for consideration to the broader society.
Let's bring – we have a caller in who would like to join in the conversation, and certainly others are welcome to do that. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. The caller's in Champaign County on our line one. Hello?
Hi. I wanted to ask you about the Mennonite involvement in the Christian Peacemaker Team movement, which is a first-hand witness kind of thing. I don't know how much you can say about it, whether you deal with them. We just have been visited by a CPT person who I believe was Mennonite from Indiana as part of a forum called Voices from Iraq, and he was there. I know they've had a presence in the middle of Hebron for quite a few years because there's quite a secular fellow who joined them to do that. And I don't know if you have to intervene with the government at all when these people get in tight scrapes, whether that's part of your charge, but I'm sure they don't get a lot of attention, and I'm terribly impressed by the courage. This fellow actually was right next to a guy who had a bomb vest on him, and he was assigned to wipe them out, and they mainly made a human contact, and it didn't happen because he came back and was able to tell about it. It was rather harrowing. By the way, this audio and video should be on local community media, including cable access, so hopefully that'll be around sometime for the people, the wider audience, to get this firsthand testimony. And I think I will just hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. Yes, Christian Peacemaker Teams is a sister organization to MCC. We work cooperatively in a number of countries around the world. CPT is made up of Quakers and Church of the Brethren and Mennonite persons, but also from other religious faiths as well. And indeed, they do some very risky kinds of things, and their whole mission was about standing between people in conflict and trying to diffuse conflict by their presence and keeping conflict from spiraling out of hand. One of the ways that our office here in Washington is connected with Christian peacemaker teams was related to their work in Iraq. Long before the Abu Ghraib scandal became public, CPT had been documenting these stories on the ground, and in January of the year that this became public, I took around CPT workers on Capitol Hill, and they met with a number of congressional offices to present their report and to raise this issue on Capitol Hill. And as a result of their report, some questions were sent down to the Pentagon to ask for further information. So they're a small organization, but they are doing some influential kinds of things.
I hope that gets at the question of the caller. Others are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest is Daryl Beiler. He's director of the Washington Office of the Mennonite Central Committee. And by the way, if people are interested in finding out more about the Mennonite Central Committee and you have Internet access, they have a website, and the address is really easy. It's mcc.org. So you can go there and find out more about them. And again, here on the program, questions are certainly welcome. Well, I think we had somebody else here lined up in Gibson City, line number one. Hello.
Yes, hello. Yes, and I happen to be with Christian Peacemaker Teams, and I happen to know that it was Cliff Kindy who spoke, and he's Church of the Brethren. And I also want to, I think it's important for Daryl to tell about the dividing wall in Israel and Palestine and how MCC has worked with that, and Christian Peacemaker Team has also been involved in that, and I think that's a very important thing to tell the people, because I don't think we hear it in the media what is going on over there. And I'm looking forward to hearing Daryl speak both at First Mennonite and East Bend Mennonite Church. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Right. Well, thanks for the call. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I think many people are aware that Israel is building a separation barrier or a dividing wall. Much of it is in the West Bank, which is the problematic thing, that it's not being built necessarily on the Green Line, which is the internationally recognized boundary between Israel and the West Bank, but it actually dips quite deeply into Palestinian territory, which makes it very controversial, and in many cases divides Palestinian farmers from their farmland. Their house is on one side of the wall, their farmland is on the other side. It divides children from their schools, people from access to their jobs, and so forth. So it is very provocative, and it's created a lot of anxiety in the Palestinian community and been very harmful to the economy. The Israeli point of view is that this barrier is needed for their security, to prevent suicide bombers from coming into Israel. But I think our sense is that if that is the case, then the wall should be built on the Green Line and not on Palestinian land. So we've tried to raise this issue quite frequently in Washington. Last year, Mennonites sent about 2,000 letters to members of Congress and the White House, encouraging what we call bridges, not walls. That can you really build a lasting security for Israelis and Palestinians by building a cement wall that in some places is 30 feet high, and it's pretty dramatic when you see it. I was there in February, and it feels very much like living inside a prison for the Palestinians who are on the side of the wall that is opposite of Israel. So we've been raising questions whether this is really in Israel's long-term security interest to create greater economic hardship and difficulty for Palestinians. There's been some openness to the message on Capitol Hill. There's obviously also a concern for Israeli security, and we're frequently reminded of that when we raise the issue. But I think this matter is certainly more known on Capitol Hill than it was a year ago as a result of a variety of Christian groups and Jewish groups here in the U.S. too, who have raised concerns about this wall.
All right. We go to another caller, and this is someone in Eureka on our toll-free line. Hello.
Join your program. I'd like to commend Denny Beiler for his work in Mennonite Central Committee office in Washington, D.C. My question is, it seems to me we're living in a strange time. Maybe all times are strange, but people keep professing God, and our president professes to be a follower of Jesus, but seems to want to completely ignore what he says about love and nonviolence, as, for instance, as illustrated in the Sermon on the Mount. Someone who I've always found a great deal of inspiration is Jim Wallis, and his trying to integrate the gospel in what one might call word and deed, faith and works. I'm wondering if you sense that there are persons now who may believe that we are at a moral crisis in our country, but that morality also includes issues such as war and peace and community and injustice and race and things like that, and whether the Mennonites may have some answers in our in the way that it calls people to follow Christ in a nonviolent way. Thank you very much.
I would agree with the sort of the premise of that comment that morality is probably much broader than the way it was often defined in the 2004 election, and that it does include issues of poverty and war and injustice, and how we as people of faith address those concerns. That those also seem to be great moral issues of our day, and that it behooves us as a faith community to be active in addressing them. Not that we necessarily neglect some of the other issues that were frequently raised in the 2004 campaign, but that there we need to take a much broader view than what I think the focus of the 2004 election was.
Hmm. Well, that's one of the things that we heard a lot about coming out of that election. I think maybe not. Maybe we heard about that right away and not so much after, and that's unfortunately, the way often the news media is, we jump from one thing to another. But the thing that we heard right after the election was the significance in that election of people who were being designated values voters, people who coming out when they talked about how they had voted, and it seemed that a lot of those people had voted for President Bush. They said to us, moral value issues are really important. Now, of course, it gets a little bit more difficult when you start asking people, well, okay, what do you mean by that? What are the things that are important to you? And that can mean a wide variety of things. But sort of the assumption was that these were people who were conservative and that the issues were things like stem cell research and prayer in public schools and abortion and homosexuality, and that those were the things that were going to dominate. Those are the issues that were going to dominate, and a particular take on those issues were going to dominate. And I think then afterwards, people started to look more closely at it and said, well, yes, values are important to people, but you've got to ask more carefully, what exactly are you talking about? I guess I'm still interested in this whole issue of how do these things end up being part of the political debate, maybe even becoming a major part of the political debate, and that we're somehow assuming that when we talk about values and values voters, that we're only talking about one kind of individual and one kind of take on those things.
Yeah, well, I guess I would come back to my earlier comments where we were trying to work at developing safe space in congregations, and hopefully something that would come out of that would be, again, a broader understanding of values, and that we don't have just a narrow slice of values when we think about what morality is. I think it is easy for us sometimes to focus on the values that don't require any change of ourselves. When you look at the teachings of Jesus, it seems like he kind of hit pretty hard those of us who carry relative amounts of power and wealth in our society. And so to neglect those kinds of values, I think we do to our peril, that while certainly there is much written in Scripture about issues of sexuality, there is a lot more written about issues of economics and wealth and how we're using power. And so it really is important that we don't divorce the whole range of values that are highlighted throughout the scriptures, and that we hold them together and seek to have a holistic approach.
How, though, given the fact that we do have a lot of people who do say that their values are important to them, and they would like to see them reflected in the way that government operates and the way public institutions operate. But given the fact that we have people who have different ideas about what exactly that means, everything from people who believe in peace, nonviolence, social justice around the world, to people whose main concern is having a teacher stand in front of a classroom and lead a class in prayer,
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that the government is actually would be able, even if it decided it wanted to, would be able to satisfy all these various constituencies. And so I think then the tactic in the past has been to say, because we can't satisfy everyone, what we're going to do is essentially back off and say we're really not going to try to satisfy anyone, and keep that hard line between the public and the private, and the political and the religious. And now what people seem to be doing is pushing the line, or saying that there shouldn't be any line at all. How, for you, in what way do you expect government is going to be able to respond to you personally and your values?
Yeah, well, I guess I would hope that government can help to create the space where all voices can be heard. And again, it seems to me that one of the things that can happen in the public square is that we put forth our ideas and we appeal to the strength of those ideas and why we think those ideas are good ones to commend to other people without imposing them on others. And so I think an important role for government is to create the kind of space where ideas can get out there and where people can be heard and make the appeals to fellow citizens that here's a position that we think is a good one for others to consider. It can be a messy process, but it's certainly better than when you have government-sponsored prayers in schools. I certainly don't want my children to have to be in a school where there would be a prayer that is maybe so generic that it has no meaning, or where I think the concern I would have about those who would argue for prayer in schools is that first of all it is allowed. I mean, people are allowed to say quiet prayers from their own tradition, and they're allowed to meet after school and so forth. But that if we take that approach, then if you live in a community that's majority Buddhist or Muslim, then we have to be ready to have those as the prayers that are offered during school. And would we in the Christian community want that? So I think it's probably I think it's not as simple as just saying we want prayer in schools, because usually what that means is we want Christian prayers in schools.
Let's talk with another caller. This is someone listening in Normal on our toll-free line. Hello.
Yes. I just want to say how very much we appreciate this opportunity to hear Daryl Beiler here in Central Illinois. And I was wondering if Mr. Beiler, I'm sure the MCC Washington office has thought about ways in which we can improve the situation in Iraq, and I was just wondering what kind of recommendations would the MCC Washington office have for U.S. foreign policy in Iraq, and how we can perhaps ameliorate the terrible situation there.
That's a tough question. I mean, MCC strongly opposed this war because of our concern that what is happening now would be exactly what happened. It didn't seem like getting into this war was going to fix the situation in Iraq. I've traveled to Iraq since what was termed as the end of major combat operations, and Iraqis are quite confused and feel very much in a catch-22. On one hand, they said, well, you've come in and you've collapsed our government, so you can't just leave because there'll be civil war. On the other hand, they said the presence of U.S. troops in a visible way is very much what is fueling the insurgent movement in our country. And so they feel trapped. And I think the best that they had to offer was that the U.S. needs to begin working toward a phased withdrawal, moving troops out of visible areas into more isolated desert areas and with the eventual goal of getting out. But there's a lot of repair work that needs to be done. I mean, the U.S., I think, took a huge hit in the international community with the way that we went into Iraq. We have not built a lot of friends around the world with this operation, and it's going to be a long time before the chaos in Iraq is going to calm down. I think in terms of what the positive things we can do in addition to working towards a phased withdrawal would be to really invest heavily in rebuilding infrastructure in Iraq, and then also to simply do a better job in the future of working through international institutions like the UN and not go into other countries in the same manner. Once you break the vase, it sometimes is hard to put back together, and I think that's what we're seeing. I personally think it would be very helpful if we could acknowledge a little more publicly as a nation the mistakes that we made in going in and be a bit more confessional in our approach.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Let me introduce again our guest. Daryl Byler is director of the Washington Office of the Mennonite Central Committee. The committee is involved in doing work around the world, sending people and resources to places where they are trying to recover from natural disaster, from war. They're also interested in helping people develop their skills for creating peace in their own neighborhoods, in their homes, in their communities. And also in a larger project, they're interested in trying to influence American government policy. He will be here in Champaign-Urbana in this area, speaking at the First Mennonite Church of Champaign-Urbana tomorrow at 7 in the evening. And then he will also speak at East Bend Mennonite Church near Fisher Sunday morning at 9:30. And anyone who is interested in attending either or both should feel welcome. Also, if you're interested in finding out more about the Mennonite Central Committee and you do have internet access, they do have a website, which is mcc.org. It's pretty easy. Or just type in your browser, Mennonite Central Committee, and you will find them. Questions are welcome here. We've got somebody lined up again and ready to go. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. This is someone listening this morning in Chicago on our line 4, toll free line. Hello.
Hello. I'm Roman Catholic, but I've been admiring the work of the Mennonites for about the last 25 years. I think the first thing was the book by Doris Longacre, The Less is More. And I'm really impressed that with a very small community, I think you've ignored your size and just kept working steadily and really done some great things. My question is this. I was a little disturbed when you said that, you know, you had to go around to the different congressmen and you left them more informed than they were before. This has been bothering me for some time because a lot of these our Congress in general, many of them are saying they had no clue about the Iraq War, about all the difficulties that were going to happen. And, you know, a lot of us in the general public who only have access to radios and TVs and just regular papers, not even including the Internet, had a lot of clues and heard a lot of different voices. So I guess my question is, I always thought that your congressperson had access to more information than the average person did, and not just information coming from the White House, but that they had aides who did research and all of this. Now I'm beginning to wonder, should the average citizen simply start clipping interesting and important articles and sending them to their congressperson to keep them informed? Because it seems like they either don't use alternative methods of information rather than briefings from White House and other officials. I just feel like there's got to be something that the individual can do, and I feel like the Mennonites have been really clever with thinking of what the individual can do. So I'd love any suggestions.
First of all, I wanted to just say that when I was right out of high school, I worked at MCC headquarters and shared a desk with Doris Longacre when she was writing the More with Less cookbook, and that has been a wonderful gift to the world. The world, indeed. Yeah. I think it is very important for average citizens to do exactly what you're talking about. Their members of Congress cannot be informed well on all the issues that are before the Congress. And we find frequently when we go into an office that we are bringing information that they don't have. Part of it is, as you suggest, that a lot of the information that members of Congress and in the administration get comes through diplomatic channels, which tends to be one tier of society. And one of the things that an organization like MCC can do is bring perspectives from grassroots and villages that may be a whole different point of view and perspective from around the world. But the idea you had of clipping newspaper articles or simply of writing out of your own experience or knowledge about an issue is very important. It is, I think, one of the things that constituents don't understand is how significant of a role they can play in educating their members of Congress. And it's not a negative reflection on members of Congress. They obviously have limits in terms of how much material they can read. But it is a way that we can influence in a very significant kind of way.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. It does strike me that what you're doing there is a difficult job, as you are in a town where a significant part of the population spends their working time trying to do the same thing that you're doing. That is, they're representing a particular constituency, and they're traveling around talking to representatives, trying to present the views of that constituency. And I think probably we'd all be surprised just how much time members of Congress and Senate actually just spend sitting listening to people like you. Your job would be tough because there are constituencies that have much louder voices and that have a lot more resources to put into just the getting out the message. How do you make yourself heard among all of those people who are trying to do the same thing?
Now, we have a little cartoon on our bathroom wall that shows a picture of a Mennonite taking a bag of lentils to a member of Congress and with kind of the joke that we've never really learned how to lobby with the wine and dine crowd. But I think the way you make yourself heard when you're not a large denomination is it has to grow out of the integrity of your message and your work, and that's where I think MCC has developed some credibility over the nearly 40 years we've been in Washington, is bringing people around to tell the stories of their work in many countries around the world, and it's good information. I've had members of Congress, their staff say that it's some of the best information they get in terms of what the real world is like out there. And so I think just the integrity of a person who spends 3 or 5 or 10 years in another country and then comes back and talks about that experience and is able to reflect on how U.S. policies could be better working in those countries. We try to stay positive. I mean, we sometimes criticize the way things are being done, but we try to offer alternative positive approaches. And if you don't have money and you don't have a huge constituency, then I think the integrity of your work is the only thing that gets you an audience.
Let's take another call in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm very happy to hear you, Daryl. I'm looking forward to hearing you at the First Mennonite Church tomorrow evening. My question has to do with dialoguing with churches and denominations that are not in the peace tradition. Has the Mennonite Central Committee developed materials for use in that, and have you had some success stories yourself in dialoguing with Christians other than Peace Church Christians about the issues of peace, poverty, and social welfare. Thank you.
Well, I think the Safe Space Dialogue materials I referred to earlier would work well ecumenically for ecumenical or interfaith dialogue as well, and those are on our website. But we do almost all of our work here ecumenically and work very closely with other denominations in Washington. And I think especially during the build-up to the Iraq War, I was amazed how many churches who don't come from the peace tradition were very concerned about the nature of this war. Even those who came from a just war tradition did not feel, many felt it didn't meet the criteria of just war. They were very concerned about the notion of preemptive war and what kind of a model that would set for other nations. So I think we're at a time where it is ripe for conversation between faith groups, and I think there are more and more Christians who are recognizing that war does not generally tend to solve problems, and that we need to look at alternative approaches to transforming conflicts in the world.
Something that I would like to ask you about that has to do, I guess, with Mennonite practice in a sense, and as I understand it, it is my understanding that one feature that you find among the various churches that are all in the Anabaptist kind of tradition is this idea that when one decides to makes the decision to become a member of the community, of the church community, that it's something that in a sense has to be a matter of informed consent, and it's only something that an adult can do, that it's something that you do as an adult with the full understanding about what it is you're committing to. Is that something, do you think, that is particularly important, or that it has a particular significance, assuming that I am not mistaken, has a particular significance for Mennonites and somehow then shapes how the Mennonite community thinks and operates?
It is true what you said. There are certainly young adults and teenagers who join the church, but the point, I think, is that it does need to be an informed consent, and that we practice what we call believer's baptism, so that it is a choice that someone makes with some level of understanding of what they're committing themselves to. And the reason that's important is because in the Mennonite tradition, the whole notion of discipleship and following Jesus in life is an important part of our faith. It's not just some verbal assent that we give to a creed, but it's a practice and a way that we live out our life, and only an adult or someone who is at an age of accountability is able to make that kind of a commitment and say, well, yes, I'm making a commitment to be a Christian, and I'm ready to shape my life around that decision. So it is very critical to our Mennonite beliefs.
Is having said that, were you born a Mennonite, or is this something that you came to later?
I grew up in a home with my parents were Mennonite, but I would say that during my college years in getting out and doing volunteer work outside our home community is when that became real to me, and it's something that I have certainly adopted as my own. But there are many, many people who come to the Mennonite Church from other backgrounds.
We're just here about the point where we're going to have to finish up and maybe have a minute or so left. Is there something that you'd like to, some idea, some thought that you'd like to leave people with before we finish?
Well, what I want to talk about tomorrow evening is an alternative security vision. And there's been a lot of focus in the recent years since September 11 about security, and it's something we're all concerned about. Our sense is that the war on terror is not working as we are currently conducting it. And those of us who said that war is not the answer, we need to have some kind of an alternative to hold out. And that's what I want to talk about tomorrow night. And again, try to lay out some positive ways that we can work to build not only a more secure nation, but a more secure world.
Well, there we can finish up our guest this morning, Daryl Beiler. He's director of the Washington Office of the Mennonite Central Committee. And as I've said a couple of times here, if you have access to the internet and you're interested in finding out more about MCC, they do have a website, and that is mcc.org. Also, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, our guest, Daryl Beiler, will be giving two talks. He'll be giving a talk at the First Mennonite Church of Champaign-Urbana, and that is tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. Then he'll also be speaking at East Bend Mennonite Church, which is near Fisher, on Sunday morning at 9:30. And the folks at both churches say that anyone who is interested in attending and hearing Daryl Beiler speak should certainly feel welcome to do that. And Mr. Beiler, we want to say to you, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be with you.
Our show, Focus 580, is made possible today by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church Street in Champaign, and the staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. Also, our show, Focus 580, is made possible by a grant from Bodywork Associates. This year, celebrating their 23rd anniversary, Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. That's just about it for us here. We'll wrap up our week just with a reminder that we are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon and have 10 different topics for you every week. Always welcome your questions and comments. Next week, Hank Spies will be back with us again to take your questions on home maintenance. That's the way that we'll start the week off. We will be doing some mixture of archives, and because of the holiday, we won't be here through the full week, but the beginning of the week we will, and of course after that. And sometime, if you're interested, you might take a look at our web archive. We have past interviews from Focus 580, also from the Afternoon Magazine, and all of our local production is available on our website, and you can listen anytime that you would like. That's WILL.UIUC.edu, and there's even an opportunity there to download for free the software that it takes to listen. So if you have a computer, you have internet access, so you might catch up on some Focus programs or AFTMAG interviews that you missed first time around. And right now, we do want you to stay tuned, because coming up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine and news and weather and sports and other things. Celeste Quinn is the host.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we will talk with Harvard biologist Peter Nascrucki. He is the author of the new book, The Smaller Majority. Most of the Earth's animals are small. More than 90% of the planet's known species are smaller than your fingernail. So this afternoon in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll venture into the world of tiny creatures. Our guide will be Harvard biologist Peter Nascrucki. Let's take a look now at prices on the Chicago Board of Trade. They're lower. December wheat, 303, down 1 3/4. March, 318 3/4, down 2 1/4. December corn, 191 1/4, down 1. March, 205 1/4, down 1 1/4. May, 213 1/2, down 1 1/2. December corn, 240 1/2, down 3/4. January beans, 570 3/4, down 8 1/2. March, 578.